Hi, my name is Jackie. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 8. I play hard because that's how I do everything. I always push myself to be the best that I can be. Type 1 diabetes does not stop me from doing the things that I like to do.
Hello and welcome to Teen 1D, the podcast for teenagers and young adults living with type 1 diabetes. The podcast is not intended as a substitute for professional medicine advice or treatment. Hello and welcome back to Teen 1D, the podcast for teenagers and young adults with type 1 diabetes. I'm Jacqueline Lynch. My guest for this episode is Dr. Phillipson. And can I have you introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Lou Phillipson. I've been on the faculty and as a diabetes doctor at the University of Chicago for over 30 years. My whole life really has been here. I had spent some quality time in Boston from New York originally, but then all my professional career has been here. My life is spent both seeing people with diabetes mostly. That's the only endocrinology I do the last couple of decades is seeing people with diabetes, mostly type 1, but also other, interestingly enough. I've had some basic science research in my background, and these days my research programs are all with people. So several programs on how we might stop or delay type 1 diabetes and some things also to do with treatment. So it's sort of all diabetes all the time, and I'm very pleased to work with a bunch of really brilliant folks who also help work with our friends and patients who have diabetes.
Thank you so much once again just for being here. And before we get started with our interview, I would like to disclose that I am a patient of Dr. Phillipson's at the University of Chicago's Kovler Diabetes Center. I'm so fortunate that Dr. Phillipson has been my endocrinologist since I've been 8. So I'm sure that some of our listeners here are thinking about pursuing a career in the medical field. Can you tell us how you decided to become a doctor and to specialize in the field of endocrinology?
So, yeah, I'm not sure that I have really a terrifically cogent, straightforward explanation for that. I think growing up, I was very interested in science in general. So I did things like photography and even ham radio and model airplanes and got more and more interested in biology, I think, as time went on. And then in college, actually majored in biochemistry. I was fortunate enough to do some research in high school in microbiology at a local hospital. So that really set me up for being interested in studying more about what at the time was biological chemistry. So I did some of that in college, the usual courses, and did more research. A lot of people have options to do, although right now in the time of COVID, it can be hard. In the back of my mind was also my stepfather, who would tell us stories about growing up in tenements in New Jersey and how he made 25 cents a shot giving people insulin in the building who had diabetes, mostly probably type 2, but there wasn't a lot of other options. And he did that when he was like 10, 11 years old, until, of course, a needle broke off in somebody's leg, and that was the end of that.
Oh, wow.
It was a crazy story. So, and that happened probably within about 15, 20 years of the discovery of insulin, because it must have been in the 1930s or 40s. So during college, I was interested in biological chemistry. And then when I decided to do a PhD in biochemistry, that's what brought me to the University of Chicago. I met people who were doing endocrinology related to the research I was doing. And actually, I met people who were amazing world leaders in diabetes, in research, and in taking care of people. And I decided I wanted to be like them. I thought what they did was very cool, that they had long relationships with their patients, and yet they were also doing interesting research. And that was a lot of the motivation right there.
So how often do you see patients during the work week? And do you spend some of your time in a laboratory as well doing research?
So I'll take the last part first. So I used to, and I still have a lab. So with benches and, you know, and glassware and fancy equipment that we still use, but mostly now I go there to visit. So I haven't actually, I direct the research, but I don't actually do that much of it. And most of the research now, except for what happens with genetics and DNA, is in what we call the clinical research center, where people would come in and we measure stuff, sometimes draw blood and do other things that help us understand where their diabetes sort of is and what we might do about it. As far as how often do I see patients, that's a little bit hard to understand. So there's, you know, there's different kinds of doctors who do diabetes. So some of them will see patients only, basically all the time. So typically that would be 4 days a week or so. What we do is we divide our days into half days. So 3 half days, basically, I see people with diabetes, which is, I say, unusual for somebody who also does research. Sometimes it's only 1 half day. But I'll see patients 3 half days a week. And also 1 month of the year, we typically see patients in hospital. So people with diabetes or other endocrine diseases, actually, who've been admitted to the hospital and need some, their other doctors need some advice from that kind of specialist. So the other, so the all the other time I spend, you know, helping run our diabetes center and also helping to understand that what the research needs to be, how to write reports and papers, and making sure we check all the important boxes.
Yes, and you talked about getting involved with research early on in your life, even as early as high school. What sorts of research have you done from then until now?
Well, quite a lot. So more than probably we have time for in the hour. But I've done everything from microbiology, bacteriology, to actual chemistry of what we call natural products. So how to understand what substances are made of and how they relate. So they were biologically important. In college, for example, I was interested in molecules that affect people who have cystic fibrosis. So that involves something called carbohydrate chemistry. And coming to the University of Chicago, I worked on molecules that are in joints and connective tissue. So those have a fancy name of glycosaminoglycans, but there are certain kinds of proteins that allow our joints to be flexible and smooth. They also are the constituents of the fluid in the eye. So I've done a lot of different kinds of research. And then as I became more interested in diabetes, I was interested in how insulin gets secreted. So that kind of research is on the interface between, I would say, biology and physics and engineering. So that was involved how electrical activities allow insulin to be released. So there's a whole story there that in order for the cells in the pancreas to release insulin, there has to be a impulse, which is at the end of the day, electrical. So we studied that for a long time. And then more recently, that has led to our work in genetics of diabetes. So it's really been, it makes sense to me when I look back, but when I talk about it, it sounds like a random walk through different parts of biology.
Yes. So was there a path that you just followed on doing these, or did it just all sort of happen in terms of knowing what you wanted to research?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, it was a lot random. It was people whom I met, things that I read that captured our interest. And then I tried to find people who knew about that and see whether I could work with them. I think in the beginning, for anybody who might be interested in going into science or medicine, it can be very difficult to decide what to do. I mean, there's sort of general ideas, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, what do you do? But it turns out that so many of the things that we do are similar that it almost doesn't matter what your first problems are that you look at. You learn a lot of the same basic techniques in the lab, but there's also things that are not lab. So that would involve the social sciences or psychology of people with, say, with chronic illness, if you were there. But my path really involved, you know, I can see clearly how one thing led to another, but it doesn't make any particular sense if you were to say, how do you get from here to there? I mean, everybody's path is a little different, and mine really depended on people I met and opportunities that happened because of that.
Yeah. So considering the fact that a large majority of our audience are young people right now, how would you recommend handling time as you do, considering the fact that you've accomplished all of these great things? And how would you advise that someone would come along finding an opportunity for scientific research?
Yeah, so time management is very difficult. When my kids were little, I used to tell them, you sleep when you're dead. And now that they're older and I want them to get some rest, they say, but Dad, you used to say. So I think that it can be very hard. I mean, a lot of these things are very time intensive. In the beginning, you need to take courses. You need to get good grades in order to get to the next level. And that really should be the focus. At the same time, you need to do other things. And I've always felt that that was really critically important. You need to have interests that may be totally different, whether it's movies or poetry or music or sports or even just working out. All of those things need to be there to give you, you know, some other thing to think about while you're pursuing the path. But time management is tricky. And in order to get to where you are, sometimes it means lots of discipline and not doing things that you might otherwise want to do in order to learn what you need to do in the short term. Everyone's situation is a little different, but there are bodies of knowledge that you just have to know in order to understand what it is you want to do next.
And turning more towards the diabetes front here, are there any areas of type 1 research, whether for a cure or a practical cure, that you think are interesting or promising?
There's so many things. It really is, has never been quite so amazing as now. I think maybe a lot of people feel that way. Maybe the Romans thought, gee, this is the greatest of all possible times. But if you had type 1 diabetes before 1920, you just died. So, you know, it was a different situation. I mean, looking back, this is the celebration of the 100th year of insulin, of the discovery of and the utility of insulin. So there's lots of celebrations going on all over the world in terms of marking that, you know, that time. But what people didn't realize 100 years ago was that the discovery of insulin was just the very beginning, that by itself, it's certainly not a cure. And I even hesitate ever to use the word cure, because to me, cure means you're done. You know, you walk away, you turn your back, and you're on to a new chapter. And many times things that are very close to a cure are sometimes indistinguishable if things can be so much better. So what we've seen in the past few years with really, on the one hand, technology. So things that make it easier for people with type 1 diabetes, or even if it is not exactly type 1 diabetes, but any intensively insulin treated diabetes, makes it easier for people to live well. And I think for the first time, we're seeing people live well for many years and not have the unfortunately terrible complications that we used to see even when I was, you know, starting out. So I can tell you that in 1980 or so, when I was doing this, in 1990-ish, when I joined the faculty, all the terrible complications of diabetes were very common in young people, and blindness and amputations and kidney disease. And while it still happens, especially in people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged, there's a big disparity there. We're seeing that technology can make a big impact. So pumps and sensors are just getting better and better, and that's helpful. Actual cures of biological replacement therapies that you can somehow teach the body to make insulin or to use insulin replacement, that's still a ways off, but it also is getting more exciting all the time. And there's a third area, which, I mean, there are many areas, but a third one is identifying people who may get diabetes before they get it and seeing, or soon after they get it, within the first few weeks or months, and giving them some sort of medicine that would delay or prevent diabetes, and so they wouldn't have those problems. So that also is picking up steam. But right now, everything is still on the horizon. The thing that's here and getting better are being able to have the sort of artificial intelligence to control your blood sugar with doing less.
Another new thing on the market right now that I know of is the fast-acting insulin. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have any patients that use it?
Sure. Well, there's now several kinds of like what we would call maybe ultra fast acting insulin. And one of my friends calls them warp speed insulins. There are two big companies that are making them right now. So faster than the designer insulins that we had been using. I mean, right now there's something like 12 or 14 different insulins on the market, if you can imagine. So they come into categories of very long, even ultra long lasting, long acting, intermediate acting, short acting, and really fast acting. But fast acting is only a few minutes ahead. So some people really feel that it makes a difference. So it really depends on the person who wants to try it. So if it makes a difference to you in your life, whether the insulin kicks in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you know, that could be a reason to try fast acting insulin. We haven't really seen these ultra fast acting insulin in pumps yet. So that is just starting to happen. And we will be seeing probably research studies on that this year, or next year, to see that there is an impact. The problem is when you do a study like that, you know, what is what we call in science, the endpoint? You know, what is the thing that we're looking for? So it could be that having an you know, having an average blood sugar, which gives you an A1C of 6.5, is really no different than 6.1. It doesn't make any difference at all. I'm just arguing that point. And yet, if the fast-acting insulin is kicking in so that you're a few points lower on average, it's not what we have to show is that that somehow improves your life. So that's one thing to think about. And is the cost of the newer insulins worth the payoff? And in some situations, we won't know that for decades. I mean, so that's a problem. On the other hand, ultra fast acting insulins may have an impact on low blood sugar. So that's a very important thing, is not having low blood sugar. So that's all a timing problem. Now, for some people, the timing problem is the insulin kicks in before the food. So you've taken your fast-acting insulin and your blood sugar goes down before it goes up because the food hasn't kicked in yet. You know, certain foods can kick in very quickly. So then the fast-acting insulin can be just the thing. I could put in a thing, you know, even inhaled insulin, which only one company makes, can also kick in very quickly. And many people, including some very prominent people, love that. But it's not for everyone. And certainly it hasn't been around for decades. So we don't know the long-term impact of putting all that insulin in your lungs. But those are some of the exciting options, as you say. So on the one hand, really fast-acting insulins, but now soon we may have a once-a-week insulin.
So you talked about the fact that the fast-acting insulin would not work for everyone. Why would that might not be?
Well, I get it. So and it's a question, I think, of cost-benefit. So if the insulin is kicking in too quickly, so let's say you have pizza. I mean, that's, you know, an essential food group, I think, especially for people in this demographic, but I think for anybody. So the problem with pizza is that it has a huge amount of carbs, and yet it can sit in your stomach for hours before it really starts to kick in. So if you were to be taking insulin injections and you take, you know, enough insulin for, let's say, I don't know, some 100 grams of pizza, of carbs in pizza, it could be that that insulin will kick in before the pizza starts getting absorbed. The cheese, the oil is sitting in your stomach along with most of the carbs. So many people find that after a pizza meal, the blood sugar doesn't rise substantially for hours later. So that could be a situation where an ultra fast acting insulin is not a great idea. Now, if you weren't putting it in an injection, but putting it in a pump, then a smart pump could actually give you the insulin as you need, as that pizza gets absorbed into your bloodstream. So in which case, it's fine. It may be hard to see any difference between the fast-acting insulin, ultra-fast-acting insulin, and the fast-acting insulin. So let me give you, you know, one other thing to think about. So we have regular insulin. So that's basically, that means God's insulin that humans make. So the brand names for that include Humulin and Novalin. And then the logs were developed. So those are designer insulins we call Aspart and Lispro. And those names refer to the genetic alterations in the insulin sequence that made the insulins a little faster. And they do that by preventing the insulins from glomming onto each other. So now we have a third generation fast-acting insulin, which basically is the same insulin structure, but has some additives in the bottle that make the insulin kick in a little quicker and also separate faster. So exactly how they're going to work in a pump versus by injection, I don't have a lot of real-world experience in my patients there yet either. But you can imagine that, as they say, it's all about timing. And you need to match the insulin to the food. So if that's what we need to see in each person, how that might work.
Thank you so much for that. I've had almost little to zero knowledge on that. And I know that background on it has just definitely given me a different way to look at all of this. I saw on the Kobler Facebook page that you did an interview recently about the FDA committee decision to support the use of a drug, Tilipizab, for delaying the onset of type 1 diabetes. Can you give us some background information on how the drug Tilipizab works, how it may delay the onset of type 1 diabetes, and what that might mean for the type 1 diabetes patients of the future?
Well, absolutely. So that's really something that is close to my heart because it really was developed at the University of Chicago almost 30 years ago. So that's how long it's taken for that drug to get to this place. So it was really developed by someone now who is, so all the people who were originally there are now gone. They're all wonderful people elsewhere. So Jeff Bluestone is a very famous immunologist who is, I think he's been chancellor at University of California in, at UCSF, at University of something in San Francisco. Another person who helped develop that was Kevin Harold, who is still a very good friend of mine. Dr. Harold is head of applied immunology at Yale. And I think that Dr. Craig Thompson might have had something to do with that also at the time. And he's been head of Sloan Kettering, the cancer center in New York City. So three very wonderful people 30 years ago thought about drugs that might interfere with the immune system. So it was, you know, it's still thought that diabetes, type 1 diabetes, is primarily an autoimmune disease. So that means some terrible mistake has happened and the body attacks itself. For those of people who are interested, there's actually a wonderful series of articles right now this month in the magazine Scientific American with some great articles on autoimmunity and type 1 diabetes in particular. And one of my acquaintances in the field, a scientist named Decio Isaric, who is originally from, I think he's from either Brazil or Argentina. Now I don't remember. And he's been working in Europe for many years and in Indiana. He is interviewed in that article as what are the points of autoimmunity. So this teplizumab is an antibody that was made in a dish against something called CD3. So that's a molecule that's very important for T cells. So you may know or may not know that white blood cells are divided up into different kinds of cells. It's an amazing mix of many, many different names. But the big categorization is T cells and B cells. And the T cells are the large group of different kinds of white blood cells that by themselves fight invaders and may suppress cancer and things like that. And the B cells are the ones that make antibodies, like many people now are familiar with in COVID, so that when you have an infection, you make antibodies. So the T cells and the B cells work together, and sometimes a mistake happens. And we think in any sort of autoimmunity, the T cells are making the wrong decision, and they start telling the B cells to also make the wrong decision. So then we start seeing antibodies against the body's own proteins. So that's what we measure in type 1 diabetes, antibodies not against COVID, but against our own insulin-secreting cells. Teplizumab was one of the first ideas for interfering with that set of steps. So by blocking this thing called CD3 and activating it in a way, it causes a temporary immunosuppression. So the idea was that you could use that drug to stop an autoimmune reaction either before it happens or as it's happening. So it's taken 30 years to go from the discovery, the idea of it, like how would you make it? How do you get able to use it in people, to start using it into mice, to people, to then saying, well, does it work in people? And then, well, it does work in some people and let's try it again. So there have been many studies, thousands of people have had the drug. And that particular panel that I spoke at was to see whether the FDA would approve it for prevention of type 1 diabetes. They voted no. The panel voted yes. The FDA decided no, that there wasn't enough information yet to make it into a drug that would do it. It has to be used. In that case, it would have been used for people who have antibodies against their insulin secreting cells. So they have to know that, even though their blood sugar is still normal. So that's hard. Well, that was done in a study called Diabetes Trial Net, which is still going on. And that's my friend Kevin Harold, who I mentioned a few minutes ago, is now the head of it. So this is a study going on in multiple places around the country to identify people who might get diabetes because they are related to people who have type 1 diabetes. So they have a slightly increased risk. So we're measuring antibodies in those people. The Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, the JDRF, has also launched the study that even if you're not related to someone with diabetes, you could get antibodies measured. Exactly why you'd want to do that isn't always obvious to me, but it can be done. And then if the antibodies are positive, drugs like teplizumab might be offered to those people in the future. Right now, outside of a research study, they're not available. So the broad answer, I know this requires lots of background information, but the simple answer is we have a study going on right now. It's available. You can Google it. It's called PROTECT PROTECT, and it's by a company that has the rights now to teplizumab. That company is called Prevention Bio, to give a plug. I mean, and we are a site for that study. It's already recruited 300 people in several countries who have new onset diabetes type 1. And the idea is that this drug then would be used in these people to see if it could delay the progression of type 1 diabetes in people who already, you know, have antibodies and are having high blood sugar. So that's hard, and I can talk about that. And also it's hard because many of these studies must be placebo controlled. So that means that not everyone gets the drug. Some people get only basically saline, salt water, because we still have to figure out against the control group whether a drug works or not. So that's basically how biological science works. So that's a long way around to that answer, but let me just finish my comments, and that is that teplizumab is only one of many, many drugs that are being studied and have been studied. I think the number is now upwards of 40 different drugs. Most of them, sadly, haven't done anything. So it's been one failure after another. And there's probably three drugs or four that are promising, but by themselves haven't done the whole job. So the next series of studies, and we have three on the books here at the University of Chicago that we're hoping to open up soon, involve other molecules with other targets to interfere with how T cells get activated, how B cells get activated, how they talk to each other. And it's certainly a concern that all of these drugs were really good ideas, and how many of them didn't work speaks to the fact that this is a hard problem. And we may not be entirely on the right path in terms of understanding how the disease works in the first place. So, as I said, these articles in Scientific American, the magazine, are really helpful to understand more background about autoimmune diseases in general, of which diabetes is just one. So long answer, but I hope that was helpful.
That definitely was helpful. I know that you said that you and the rest of the world are not completely sure how the disease works. And along with that, I just wanted to bring up monogenic diabetes. Could you explain that to our audience and what might mistakenly be diagnosed at type 1 and what that really is?
Well, thank you so much for asking that. I didn't know that you were going to go there. So one of our own big research interests here in Chicago for 25 years has been unusual forms of diabetes. So many people know about type 1 and type 2, and maybe even something called gestational diabetes that happens when women are pregnant for complicated reasons. But there seems to be other. So type 1, type 2, and other. And many of those other are caused by mutations, variations in single genes. So that's where the name monogenic comes from. Mono meaning one, and genetic for genic. So monogenic diabetes. So what's interesting about them is that they're not autoimmune by the most part. In fact, well, we can get into that. There is a subtype that is autoimmune, but that is even more complicated. But most of the ones that we study are what we call dominantly inherited. So they run from one generation to the next. They're usually not so severe. But because many doctors never heard of them, and of course, many people have them never heard of them, when a young person, say in their teens or 20s, gets diabetes, it's off, and they're not, say, overweight, many people then assume that they have type 1 diabetes and start them on insulin right away. But for these monogenic forms, oftentimes pills are the right approach. The pills can work even better than insulin. So, and there's quite a lot of them. There's easily 15 different genes now that we know that can cause some of these forms of diabetes. And some of them have been called MODY. That was the original name. So maturity onset diabetes in young people. So that was because it was up until about the age of 25. And so, you know, not children. But that distinction is soft. And it turns out that you have to look into more things than that. And then there are some really rare things that happen to babies. So also single genes, so still monogenic. But these are babies who either essentially are born with diabetes or get diabetes in the first, say, 6 to 8 months of life. So that's really weird. And until recently, that was like not understood at all. But over the last, I would say, 15 years, there's been a lot of work on that as well. And that's something that we've also been very much involved with. And even a movie. So one of our families whose child we diagnosed around 2006 made a movie about monogenic diabetes, really, and neonatal diabetes, so diabetes that the child was born with. And that movie is available for streaming. I didn't think I would be mentioning that in this talk, but it's called Journey to a Miracle, about the discovery of monogenic diabetes. It's a very interesting movie about, so there's some, I'm in it, frankly, about, I talk about how insulin gets secreted, and there are some other very important scientists who are in the movie, both here and in other countries, in England in particular. So it is a fascinating thing. I think it's available for streaming, but I'm not sure exactly which services will do that. But you can download it or stream it, and it will tell you a lot about what we knew a few years ago about monogenic diabetes and how it might differ from type 1. But some kinds of monogenic diabetes are basically indistinguishable from type 1 diabetes. You still need to have insulin all the time and checking your blood sugar. The difference is each child that those people might have would have a 50-50 chance of having the same thing. That's what dominant genetics is all about. Whereas if you have type 1 diabetes, your children are at slightly increased risk, you know, maybe 5% instead of 0.3% or 0.03%, but not to the point of 50%. So there are important differences in those kinds of monogenic diabetes that both are about why it happens, how to treat it, and how it could be communicated from one generation to the other. And then a fourth difference is that oftentimes there are other organs that are involved. So that's very important. Some of them weirdly could involve learning disorders or kidney function. So understanding exactly why somebody has diabetes is now more critical than ever. So we need to know when someone has diabetes. We advocate now for certain tests like antibody tests to be absolutely sure we have a good idea of why diabetes is happening and the best thing to do about it.
To go along with that, you talked about understanding why a person has diabetes. When someone is first diagnosed or when they suspect someone of having type 1, why would a doctor not do an antibody test earlier?
Yeah, so that is a spectacular question. I think part of it is that we have sort of rules, and although I suppose they're more guidelines than rules in terms of what tests are done in what order. And there are some people who still think, well, goodness, you know, 98% of every six-year-old who has diabetes is going to be type 1. And that's true. But it still helps, both from a research point of view and possibly an interventional point of view, to know about antibodies. And on the other hand, if you're 45 or 65 years old and you have new onset diabetes, it's certainly possible you have type 1 diabetes. The chances seem to be less because there's a peak of type 1 diabetes in sort of childhood and young adulthood, but it can happen at any age. So knowing antibodies in basically everyone who has new onset diabetes is, to me, a good idea. I mean, you know, is it cost effective? You know, all right, so maybe, you know, there's some cost associated with any blood test. But, and there are people who do this for a living. They would calculate, like, what is the added cost of measuring antibodies in every single person so that you pick up, you know, X number of cases of type 1 that you might have missed or been delayed. So there's ways of calculating if that is cost savings or not. But I certainly am one of those people who advocate knowing more rather than less and being sure that we have the tests that, you know, that might change treatment if we knew early on that this is type 1 and not type 2, for example.
Along those same lines, why don't primary care doctors do a urine or blood glucose test at every appointment to test for type 1 diabetes? Are those inexpensive or would this be super inconvenient for them to do in general?
You know, I think it is a question of statistics, you know, and what is common. I think many pediatricians are doing basically well child visits. And the expectation is that most of the children will be well and only a fraction will be sick. So doing simple things like growth curves. I mean, when I see children, which, you know, I'm a trained as an adult endocrinologist, but as you know, I see some children, measuring the height and weight of children and putting that on standard growth curves is very powerful, reassuring to pediatricians and primary care doctors that that child is growing. So if you are losing weight or falling off the growth curve, that's certainly an indication that something's happening. If a child is losing weight, you know, that could be a sign. Certainly adult doctors actually have more of an expectation that something bad could be happening. And so once a year, many adult physicians, general practice, internists, family doctors will get that urine test or a standard blood test. But they're looking for more stuff than just diabetes. Yes. So I don't know that there's a great answer for that. But I think generally speaking, there is this cost-effectiveness idea that you know, unless you can have some idea that somebody's at heightened risk, that you don't go looking for trouble, maybe.
Yes. And I'm just going to thank you once more for being here. We're about to the end of our list of questions, but you are just fantastic to be here to speak with. And you've traveled all around the world speaking for conferences and other events. What advice do you have for people looking to speak publicly?
Well, I think in general, I know what you're talking about. So, you know, that's like the old joke about writing. You know, if someone wants to write novels or books, you know, write what you know in the first situation. So, you know, at my stage of the game, I've been doing diabetes and diabetes research for something like 40 years. So I have a good sense of what the problems are. I've been honored to take care of lots of amazing people like you who are doing great things. And I try to learn from everyone. So I think that's part of it, to learn, keep learning, share what you know, but always try to keep an open mind and realize that we don't know everything. And we sometimes learn things from the most unlikeliest of places.
And the last thing that I have to say is thank you again for being here. And that's all we have for today.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. And I hope if there are other questions or people write to you that you let me know, and I'm happy to continue the conversation.
Okay. Thank you. That's all for today. If you have any suggestions for future topics or guests, or just want to say hi, don't hesitate to reach out. You can email me at teen.t1d@gmail.com or DM me on Instagram at teen1dpodcast. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review, as it really does help me out. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to turn into next week's episode. Have a great week. Bye.